Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Neil Sample to the broadcast. Neil is the Senior Vice President and Chief Information Officer of Express Scripts, a $100 billion revenue pharmacy benefit management company. Since joining the organization in early 2016, Neil has focused on innovative solutions, process improvements, and increasing productivity. Prior to joining Express Scripts, Neil held several executive-level positions with American Express's Enterprise Growth Unit, including president, CIO, and chief marketing technologist. Neil's also held technology leadership roles at eBay and at Yahoo. Neil earned a bachelor's degree and a master's degree in computer science from the University of Wyoming. He also holds a master's degree and a PhD in computer science from Stanford University. I recently caught up with Neil in his office in St. Louis, Missouri. Our conversation covered world-class IT Principle 1, People, as Neil described, Express Scripts' apprenticeship to hire program. Principle 2, Infrastructure, as we discussed how Neil, during his relatively short tenure as CIO, has modernized the IT department's technology and processes. We also discuss the intersection of health and technology, the steps Neil takes when preparing for a new position, how being intellectually curious and willing to admit what we do not know can lead to innovation, and a variety of other topics. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Thank you. The Forum on World-Class IT is brought to you by TopTal, an exclusive network of the top freelance software developers, designers, and finance experts in the world. I recently caught up with TopTal CEO Tasso Duval, and he offered the following top five trends for hiring top talent.
The top five trends for hiring top talent are, one, hiring talent remotely, ensuring that they are able to work remotely and that companies are hiring talent remotely. Two, leveraging teams in different dispersed locations. If you're hiring in-house and you're leveraging remotely a bit, being open to having talent even in the same time zone is an important factor that we've noticed. Three, highly skilled teams becoming the majority rather than the lead, meaning ensuring that the team composition comprises of predominantly high-skilled labor rather than high-skilled labor supported by lower-skilled labor. Four, infrastructure being created to support those teams, ensuring that the teams in-house are connected with the remote teams that are working together. And five, flexibility with offer packages. We've seen that even the in-house talent that are joining companies from Google to Facebook and on are interested in demanding that there is a remote component to their job, whether it's one day a week or full time, be included within their offer packages.
Neil Sample, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thank you.
Great to speak with you today. Neil, I thought we would begin with your role. You are the Chief Information Officer of Express Scripts, in excess of $100 billion revenue pharmacy benefit management company based in St. Louis. You've been in that role for more than a year and a half, between a year and a half and 2 years now. And I know that you've been in the throes of quite a transformation across that time. And I wonder if you could just take a moment across the sweep of your tenure at Express Scripts and describe the department you found and the changes made across that time.
You know, what we found when I started a year and a half ago was probably what was expected based on how Express Scripts grew over 20 years, that it was primarily inorganic growth, which meant a lot of acquisition. And the pattern was fairly consistent, which was, you know, another PBM or a related business would be purchased, integrated. We would capture the synergies from that integration and use that leverage to acquire the next business. And in doing so, you find that oftentimes, you know, you don't get the synergy that you're looking for from a technology perspective. You don't end up with the systems that you would have designed if you had a blank sheet of paper. It's not 1 + 1 = 3. It's more like 1 + 1 = 1. So there's a lot of glue code, for example, where systems weren't retired, or there's a lot of systems that might have been upgraded if this was your ongoing concern, but instead you're integrating the next company and focusing less on the infrastructure. So what I would say is we found a situation where there was a lot of tech debt, a lot of technology debt. We had outdated systems. We had a plethora of systems. We had, I think it was 31 development languages. And so any technology stack you could imagine was probably present. It didn't matter if you said mid-range or mainframe or on-premise cloud or off-premise, it was all there. And so really, there was an opportunity to do some cleanup to enhance our reliability. From a business process perspective, development was primarily waterfall, which meant that not only was it longer cycle times and fairly expensive, but it was also rigid in the ability to respond to the market. What we knew is we had our work cut out for us. So we took a long, hard look at that environment and said, you know, where do we start first? Do we start with people, process, or technology? And we kind of answered yes, all three. So we began a tech debt retirement program along with a move from waterfall to agile from a process perspective, and then a real focus on hiring and attracting talent, bringing folks in-house that years of outsourcing probably left us a little light to do the transformation ourselves. So came in with what I like to think of as a target-rich environment in all three areas, in people, process, and technology, and then began chipping away.
That's excellent. And I know that part of your purview as CIO is also one of innovation. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of the, as you've taken care of some of the efficiency part of the equation, trying to get more to that 1+1=3 equation, which I like that analogy. What sorts of ideas have you been pursuing that might be classified as innovative ideas across that same time frame?
That's a really good question. For us, innovation is now sort of front and center for the company in a way that during the heavy integration period, it probably wasn't as emphasized. And so as we think about growing the company through organic initiatives, that means innovation is going to be a significantly larger part. And so when I think about how technology drives innovation and how innovation drives technology both at a company like Express Scripts, the first thing we start with is an understanding that essentially the entire healthcare experience from our PBM perspective is driven by technology. Even if you show up with a handwritten script to a retail pharmacy, that then goes into a network. It goes back to, say, Express Scripts or another PBM, gets adjudicated. We do drug utilization review, safety checks, that sort of thing, and then send a response back. Even where the member doesn't know immediately, technology is involved. In our home delivery pharmacy, for example, it's a highly automated robotic system that, you know, serves hundreds of millions of prescriptions a year. And again, powered by technology. That's why it's in fact better, faster, and cheaper. And then finally, consumers have technology in their own hands. And so we find that the folks who, for example, download and use our application can find the pharmacies near them, can find the best prices at those pharmacies, can get generic alternatives that are specific to their plan design, that there's a tremendous amount of control you can exert over your own healthcare experience if you're fully technology enabled. But what I really find fascinating is the opportunity to change the game. When we think about technology with big data, we're able to take a look at adherence or compliance, whether or not a particular individual is going to stick to their drug regimen. And it's very important that they do so that they get a positive medical outcome and ultimately lower the cost of their own care. And so we do a tremendous amount of work with big data. But even in the small, we've now recently come out with a program called InsideRx, which is at InsideRx.com, which allows a consumer to come in and look at our essentially best price, our cash price, and find that even if they have benefits through another provider, that they may be able to use our program to get an even better price. And as we know, in a world of high deductible health plans, this can be really powerful. In the past, that wasn't really possible. For consumers to comparison shop drug prices online is a relatively new phenomenon. And the ability to acquire benefits outside of their plan, again, wasn't the kind of thing that we would even have imagined 10 years ago. And nowadays, it's right in the palm of your hand, powered by technology.
You mentioned earlier that one of the transformations that was necessary was one of people. One of the things I know from our past conversations, Neil, that I found particularly interesting is not only, of course, are you mindful of the need to hire the next generation of technologists and leaders to the organization, the so-called millennials, but you've also thought very creatively about what I believe you've referred to as apprenticeship to hire, which also includes second career adults. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the rationale as well as the value you've derived from it.
Absolutely. You know, we found that that was a really rich source of talent, that a lot of these folks that do come to us through apprenticeship of various sorts have a really remarkable perspective that may come from a different industry or a different discipline. And they've decided that they would like to get into technology, either because they want to change careers, because they want to re-enter the workforce, and in some cases that they want to, you know, upgrade their earning potential. So we were faced with a conversion where we literally had thousands of contract and consulting resources. And, you know, what we knew, especially as part of the Agile process, was that stable teams of employees were going to outperform on average over time. One of the things we had to figure out was how could we bolster the number of employee resources that we had. Hiring thousands of folks over a short period of time is a daunting task, even without needing a specialized workforce. Unfortunately, in technology, there's a fairly high barrier to entry. So what we did is we realized that we had particular needs, and I'll give you one example of an unmet need that was even difficult in the market, and that was the need for COBOL programmers. That having a diverse stack, technology stack that's got a lot of legacy, we found that our COBOL programmers, many of them were getting ready for retirement, and there wasn't a replacement pipeline coming out of the current educational system. So we saw this really intriguing opportunity to match these second career folks through the apprenticeship program with a specific business need that we had, which was COBOL programmers. And we joined in partnership with a program called Launch Code, which is a national nonprofit that actually started in St. Louis. And so not only do we have folks who teach themselves how to code through online training courses, but then we've created a module in conjunction with Launch Code to help create COBOL training courses. And then we've had several successful cohorts come through the program now, and we've hired dozens of folks who now have a skill set that otherwise didn't really exist and wasn't really being replenished in the open market, and they're supplementing our workforce. What I can say is they've also been very productive. When I think about the difference, some people say we'll hire for will over skill. These are folks, especially in the second career apprenticeship group, that really want to become computer programmers in a lot of cases. They have this abiding conviction that this is the right thing for them to do. They come in self-taught and then take an incremental training program, and they've got just an unmatched enthusiasm for their roles and are filling a gap that was otherwise hard to fill. So it was one of these really powerful win-win situations.
You also have advanced degrees in computer science, not only a bachelor's, but also a master's in the discipline from the University of Wyoming, a master's and a PhD from Stanford. It's interesting, you know, as someone who has spent a considerable time in your career in Silicon Valley prior to your move to the East Coast and now the Midwest, it seems like that level of education has fallen out of fashion. You have the Peter Thiels of the world, who ironically, of course, has a law degree from Stanford himself, who's saying that even an undergraduate degree is no longer necessary and that people ought to start businesses straight out of high school in lieu of going for the next stage of education. Can you speak a bit about the value you have derived from having gone so deeply into a discipline, obviously a discipline that you're still leveraging in various ways today in computer science? I don't necessarily ask you to, as a counterweight to some of the ideas that are in vogue in Silicon Valley and elsewhere, but I'd be just curious your own impressions about the value of having spent such considerable time on your education.
Yeah, absolutely. I will say it started in large part because I envisioned myself ultimately as being an educator. However, being at Stanford in the doctoral program in the 90s, it was essentially impossible to not join a startup. At least as a consultant. You know, I found it interesting when I got to Stanford, you signed a consulting agreement that said as a doctoral student, you would limit yourself to a single consulting day a week. And my first impression was, well, gosh, why would I need that? You know, I am a student. And boy, I'll tell you, by the end of my second year, I was negotiating with the university to get that limit removed. So in my personal experience, I found that it was a real eye-opener to go from sort of being academic and teaching and having a depth in knowledge to building systems. And so that was what drew me essentially away from the academic path. But there was a moment when I could have easily not finished, if you will. So I was at Stanford during my first startup period and actually didn't graduate until after I had joined Yahoo, my doctorate. But what I would say is I essentially finished it. And at that point in time, it was a powerful time to have a deep understanding of the technology in my case. So for example, became chief architect of the consumer products group while at Yahoo. During that point in time, you know, it was really intriguing because you built the software yourself, that a lot of the open source movement was just gaining steam. A lot of the products that we count on today for data and analytics were just getting started. You know, having that deep technical savvy was really, really important because you were essentially building the platforms that you were on. What I would say is, you know, Peter's comments have some validity that it is almost easier now, that there are a lot of off-the-shelf open source or turnkey solutions that mean you don't necessarily need the technical depth. But what I would say is that if you're going to operate at the highest levels with the highest level of effectiveness, that being a little bit overeducated and frankly versed in the art and understand your discipline deeply is only an asset, that it is not something that gets in the way. You know, my ability, for example, to sit down with developers and review their CSS for their front end presentation sometimes shocks them, but that it's possible. But at the same time, I know generally builds credibility within the team, develops the followership. It's seen as somebody who understands, you know, what I am doing. And then ultimately helps me from a decision-making perspective, that the ability to evaluate a product opportunity in my space, in the technology space, and understand it as well or better in some cases than a vendor-provided solution allows us to make better decisions. So, you know, I don't think it's for everybody, but I think as you get to the peak of this career, it's certainly helpful and can only lead to better outcomes.
So we've talked about some rising trends. What are some others that you are particularly excited about as you look to the future, say a couple years out? What are some of the things that are starting to make their way onto your strategic roadmap?
You know, I'm in a fortunate position to see a real intersection between my discipline and domain in healthcare and technology in general. And so one of the things I would see as coming really, really rapidly is the high utility wearable. And so for a long time, people have been talking about wearables. They've been talking about, integrated speaker systems within a jacket. They've been talking about pedometers. They've been talking about the iPhone or the Android phone as essentially a general purpose computer that you also keep as a fashion accessory. And to some extent, that has been true. You know, you can measure your steps and you can find your lost keys. But within healthcare, we're actually starting to see these high utility wearables that are allowing us to do data and telemetry to get metric on our users in a way that are actually going to enhance their healthcare outcome. And so if I think about even being on the phone with you right now, I've got my watch on and my watch is not only measuring my activity and measuring my motion on a regular basis, but it's also taking heart rate and also measure sleep times. And so all of those things now are data that contribute to an overall health picture that is coming from those wearable technologies. As we look to the future, we're seeing even more sensitivity expression in these devices. So we can see, for example, a future where devices are reporting out on their status. And so these may be embedded devices like insulin pumps or pacemakers, but we're also seeing monitoring devices as well that can look at blood glucose levels, for example, in real time and use that data to do alerting to say that there might be a glucose event coming for a diabetic, that sort of thing. So I think that the ability for wearables to interface with the human behind them and actually make a difference, that's what we're on the cusp of. That, you know, it'll always be great to have a phone and it'll be a fantastic distraction and you'll be able to access your apps and your music and everything else. But the fact is that these devices are now at a place where they can help encourage us to lead a better, healthier lifestyle and can forestall medical events. That to me is amazing.
One last question, Neil. Interesting in hearing your response to get a sense for your own curiosities and interests and very evidently your excitement about the future of technology and healthcare. You know, it strikes me as we've just done a bit of a review of your career, mentioning some of the roles you've had at companies like Yahoo and eBay and American Express before joining Express Scripts. I'm curious, you joined a new industry, one you'd not had experience in terms of your career, obviously a user of healthcare in a variety of ways, as we all are. And I'm curious, in joining such an important industry, but one that you had not worked in before, what the process was to educate yourself? How did you come up to speed on the terms, the metrics, the ecosystem, and so on, to ensure that you were connecting the dots appropriately? And I'm also curious, I guess a related point, the advantages at least of the early stages of your quote-unquote ignorance to the shibboleths and norms that may represent areas that were in need of change.
You know, it is interesting. I've always encouraged folks who worked with me in the past or that I've counseled to take some significant risk every time you move a job, and to do so in a way that teaches you something new. And sometimes those risks might be that, you know, you stay within the same company, you stay within the same relative level of seniority, but you actually move to a different function, or you move to a different discipline. Or, you know, you stay within the same industry and you stay within the same function, but you take on a role that has significantly more scale. Or conversely, you know, maybe you keep the same function and the same scope, but you move into a different industry. And so in each of those situations, if you're changing scale or you're changing function or you're changing domain, there's a real opportunity to learn, but it's also backed up by the opportunity that you bring to the table by keeping one or two of those variables fixed, that you have those skills. I mean, you have that experience that you can draw on. So for me, in this case, healthcare was the new space, but it was ultimately at a scale and within a function that I was comfortable. And so the real key was to learn about pharmacy benefit management. The way I started was, of course, in a very traditional way. Before joining the company, did a lot of independent online research to research the company, but then also to look at analyst view of the company, and then expand that out to say, what do they think of the sector? What do they think of the market? And then start with that as a foundation. From there, I was given a lot of access to senior leaders at the company and could test hypotheses with them, you know, figure out essentially what was right, wrong, or indifferent coming from the outside in view. And so match that to the inside out view. And so that was a really interesting process. And I think that you eventually hone in on the things that you need to know. So the new learning experience, I would say, is creating that 360 kind of outside in view plus inside out view, and then really to expand it a lot. The second part of the question, you know, what are the things that I didn't know that have actually been advantage? What I will say is that is the very first step. You know, if you have intellectual curiosity and you're willing to be vulnerable and express the fact that you don't know, the amount of opportunity that opens up is tremendous, that you can ask fairly naive questions. And in many cases, you'll get an answer that simply improves your knowledge base. But every once in a while, you'll find an example, you'll say, well, why do we do it this way? You know, you'll get an answer that is sort of like, well, that's just the way we've always done it. And then you'll open the door a little farther and say, well, have we thought about other alternatives? And then you can start building, you know, analogies from previous experiences, whether, you know, in my case, financial services or consumer internet, marketing and online retail. And you can bring those experiences to bear, and you will find that there is a new perspective that hasn't been considered before. And you'll be able to create some interesting value. What I would say, though, is that requires both the curiosity and the vulnerability on the part of a new executive, that you have to want to know, and you have to be willing to express the fact that you don't. But if you are, again, I think, at least in my case, we found some really interesting opportunities in an industry that's somewhat mature, and yet that maturity is ripe for innovation. And so in my own case, there was, a fairly extensive but standard learning process, followed by a willingness to admit what I don't know, has led to some interesting opportunities.
Neil Sample, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT. It's been a great conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you, Peter.
Thanks for listening to the Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please rate us on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please join us next week when my guest will be Paula Tolliver, the Chief Information Officer of Intel. You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to Meta Strategies' five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.